we have everybody on the phone.
Okay, I'm just hearing the 9 o'clock chimes, and the timer just timed out, so I think that's our cue to start. First of all, this is Dave Moak from Montana, and let me again welcome everyone back to the second day of the Understanding Deep Earth workshop. I think we had a fantastic day yesterday, huge amount of great science that we saw. We're going to have some more coming up. We'll talk about the plume controversy and with Brennan Jordan, and then this afternoon we'll come back and take a look at deep seismic imaging with Ray Russo. For this opening session, what I wanted to do was to review some of the input that we've had from all of the participants, in part from your introductory statements, from the threaded discussions, and from some of the notes that you sent about the type of teaching activities that you would like to engage. And I kind of summarize these by groups, and I don't mean to pigeonhole people, but I'm trying to group people according to their common interests. And this might be the start of some really neat working groups for the rest of the workshop. So what I'm going to do is show a brief compilation of the input we got from the threaded discussions. And again, this is going to be a first step towards organizing some of the working groups. I think you'll find that there's a lot of kindred spirits out there, and maybe you know some of the people who are working in the same field, and maybe this will be an opportunity to make some new friends as well. And even though I kind of broke out the following discussion along disciplinary lines, let me just encourage everyone to think about integrating across disciplines, and Anna had a really good comment about the need to integrate data from all these sources, such as EarthScope, IRIS, the Hawaiian Volcano Observatory, EarthChem, and PETDB. And so I don't think any one discipline owns deep Earth, but all have something important to contribute. So there's probably a lot of good interdisciplinary work that we can do here. So let me just go through this brief compilation, and what I'm going to do is give kind of an overview of the comments, and then I'm going to ask perhaps a couple of individuals to go ahead and unmute their phones, and we do this by typing in star six, and I may ask you for maybe just a few additional comments or thoughts that you have on the topic that you have indicated. So here we go. There is a group that you can see here that is interested in mineral physics, and some of the topics that came across our radar screen was looking at the various physical properties and processes of minerals at depth. And Kanani had a really neat idea about a demonstration to show gravity changes. I think she was using corn syrup, and I'd sure like to hear more about that. A number of people talked about integrating subdisciplines, and Wendy and Laura and Anna all talked about that. And then Anne also made some comments about it would be really good to get some new problem sets on phase transitions and possibly discontinuities. So I'm just going to ask, is Glenn Richard out there? If Glenn could maybe unmute and tell us a few words about what's going on at Compress and some of the things that he sees on the horizon. I see that Glenn is logged on. Monica, can you track down his phone line?
I'm not sure. If you'd never used star six to mute yourself in the first place, don't use it to unmute. Or if you did, just do it again. I'll look for him in the phone list. Hang on 1 second.
Like he's typing something into the chat window right now.
We'll just give this one more second. Okay. Okay, well, let me just ask, I'm kind of scrolling through here. I don't see that Kanani is online. Wendy or Laura, are you out there? You want to share some of your thoughts about what you would like to see developed?
Hi, this is Wendy. I am participating largely because we have to completely overhaul our curriculum and to include significantly fewer classes. And so the goal is to come up with a variety of tools and kind of things that we can just be inserted into courses, particularly team talk courses, to make sure that all of the content is included in our undergraduate curriculum.
Okay, so you're looking for opportunities to get ideas about the Deep Earth kind of across the curriculum, maybe inserted into some type of, maybe a petrology course or a tectonics geodynamics course?
Yes, exactly. You know, everything from the intro level up so that it's a coherent curriculum and to have the Deep Earth included in that coherent curriculum.
Yeah, it would be really neat to have a theme, something about earth materials and all their variety, to have that be a common thread all the way through the curriculum, and then maybe something about process and time and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see. So Wendy's here. Ann, are you online? Can you join us?
Hi, this is Anna Courtier. Hopefully you can hear me. So I'm interested, actually I got into this a lot by integrating a lot of my research into teaching, and I'm a seismologist, but I use a lot of mineral physics to help out with interpretations and that sort of thing for these mantle discontinuities, which are sharp changes in mantle properties for those who aren't in the same business. So I actually added this idea to the very end of the second discussion thread just now, actually just before we started, but one of the things that I tried in a class that I taught last spring with Liz Johnson here at James Madison University was giving them a problem set where they had a result from research and then had to interpret it in two or three different ways using a pure temperature anomaly or a pure water anomaly or iron content or something like that, and trying to get the students to think about which one of these were the most reasonable explanations when in truth it's probably a combination of a variety of factors. And this seems to fit in pretty well with some of the ideas that people have had, people have been suggesting for tomography as well.
Cool. Let's see, is Pam with us today? I don't see her logged on. I think that she might have had a class. What about Ben? I don't see Ben either. Monica, any leads on getting Glenn patched in?
Not muted on my end, so I'm guessing it's something with the phone line on his end. Okay, that's a good idea. I'll also just give him a couple minutes.
Okay, we'll come back to Glenn. He's going to try to log in again. Let's take a look at a group that kind of nucleated around seismology, and there were a huge amount of great ideas here. Certainly Earthscope and IRIS data is at the forefront, and John Tabor and Vince Cronin have been working in that realm for quite some time. I put this note up about tutorials on geophysical data and data products. As a mere mortal petrologist, it would be hugely helpful for me if I could understand better just what the seismic signals are and what we can learn from them about the structure and perhaps infer composition of the deep crust. And
hello?
Hi, is that Glenn?
Ah, there you are. Hello, everybody. I finally got my voice back.
Okay, well, I'll tell you what. I'm going to go back a slide here. And Glenn, why don't you tell us a little bit about what's going on with Compress and some of your thoughts on properties and processes of minerals at depth.
Okay. Well, the main mission of COMPRESS is to make facilities for doing high-pressure experiments available to researchers across the country and, in fact, around the world. And we, for instance, we have some equipment at Brookhaven National Laboratory and other sites in the United States. And so we do workshops to enable people to learn about using this equipment. We facilitate various forms of outreach. There are summer programs at some COMPRESS institutions. COMPRESS has member institutions all around the United States, in excess of 50 institutions and additional institutions around the world. And some of these institutions have summer programs where students do research. They may be on campus for 10 weeks over the summer. So I think we'd be in a good position to facilitate learning about high-pressure equipment and the sorts of experiments that are done using that equipment.
Okay, and did you have some ideas about some specific types of problem sets that might you might want to see developed?
Well, I was going to mostly wait to hear what other people wanted to do and help them, but what I would suggest is we could some people suggested during the in the threads having virtual field trips to laboratories. So one thing we could do is facilitate the development of those virtual field trips by having activities, visuals that would illustrate how some of these experiments are done, perhaps visuals that illustrate phase changes that might take place during high-pressure experiments, and also interactive modules where students could try to perform simulated virtual experiments.
All right. Well, great. Well, I'm going to move on just to keep us moving so that we can stay on schedule. Let me go back to the seismology. And as Glenn came in, I was just saying it would be just great if we could have just some basic information about the various geophysical analytical tools that we have so that I could introduce these at least at a rudimentary level to my students and so that we can better understand the types of images that we've seen the last couple days between Mike and Gene's talks and more that we'll see a bit later. So, Ray, I think you're online. You're going to be talking this afternoon a bit more, but do you see some opportunities to help students navigate through this wonderful world?
I'm assuming you want me to talk on the phone, is that right?
Yeah, please.
Okay, great. Yes, I think there are, although with most of these things, in order to really grasp them, there's a fair amount of background info that has to come into play before a student is going to feel, I think, comfortable in understanding these sorts of things. So you can, I think, at the undergraduate level, for example, you can explain them with pictures and maybe leave out equations. Things like receiver functions may be a bit more amenable to that treatment than, say, for example, shear wave splitting, which I think is a bit more complicated. But yeah, I fully believe that these sorts of things, which are active research areas, should be integrated as quickly as possible at the lowest level possible, because that's where people feel excited about what they're doing and they communicate that excitement. So yeah, I would be good with that.
All right. Well, great. Well, I was really delighted to see that a number of people really wanted to use quantitative exercises and then computational exercises as well. And let's see, Catherine, you're online. Do you want to give us a little bit of background about the type of quantitative exercises you think might happen?
Sorry, you just got me with a mouthful of an apple. I'm like, oh!
I'm sitting here with my own double latte, so.
Well, I don't know. I'm actually stumped because, I mean, I have the students go ahead and work their, like, homework problem set, but they still just seem like, well, why am I doing this? This isn't really necessarily important, and I'm not really seeing where it's connecting back to the big picture. So I think Anna was hitting at it is like having something that you could do both in a quantitative way and also maybe in a graphical way. So that way you can get both kind of types of learners. I mean, I certainly have students that have no problems with the math and can see the math and understand the equations, understand if you change something in the equation, how it would then end up being. But I have others who would just look at it and just completely lost and do not get how any of this relates back to the Earth. So that's kind of what I'm hoping to get out of this.
Mm-hmm. So some kind of, computational approach, but also maybe a graphical or visualization approach to,
right, I think
to make the equations come alive.
Yeah, that would be nice.
All right. And Anna, you just typed in a note here. Do you want to chime in on the quantitative exercises?
Well, I think that the note that I just typed in was more about dual-purposing some of these activities. I've been to some CIDR workshops where people have expressed an interest in having a resource for grad students to kind of prepare on their own prior to like an intensive summer workshop. I think that's something that could double really well as an undergraduate in an undergraduate curriculum with more focused instruction to go with it. And I think as far as quantitative side of things goes, you know, a lot of my students sort of run the other direction when I tell them they're going to have to do the math. It'd be nice to have something to guide them through to sort of not only help them to do it, but help them realize that they can do it on their own a lot. And that's, I think, probably the level that some of the graduate students are closer to as far as the tutorials go.
I will say that at the CERC site, we have quite an extensive teaching quantitative skills in the geosciences module, and there's all kinds of great resources, both for faculty teaching quantitative skills, but also students learning quantitative skills. And so maybe some of those resources could be used to help support the approach as well. Let me just say also, Mike Brzezinski, I don't see that he's online right now, so I'll just say quickly that he made a distinction that he really wanted his students to do computational exercises using some of the really cool software that's out there, and he made a bit of a distinction between computational approach and quantitative approaches, but it seems to me that those could be quite complementary, and so maybe something we might want to pursue as well. And then, of course, Gene Humphreys, he's not with us immediately, but, of course, he's very interested in looking at geodynamic modeling. So, okay, well, those are some great ideas kind of nucleated around seismology. Let me just go through here. Glenn just mentioned the great instrumentation that's available through Compress, and, of course, many other people are doing experimental and analytical work. And I'll just say that if anybody is interested in helping develop some tutorials and what these instruments are and how we use them, I'd certainly be delighted to work with somebody to further develop that. Well, let me go on to kind of another subset. I just lumped this as petrology geochemistry, broadly defined. And I don't see that Ben is with us, so I'll just put in a plug for looking at Xenolith. It turns out that Roberta Rudnick has recently put in something like 2,000 analyses of xenoliths from around the world into the EarthChem database, and I think it'd be just great to do some kind of exercise using thermobarometry, trace element modeling, that type of thing to see what xenoliths can inform us about the mantle and the deep Earth. Brennan, I know you're online. Would you take just a minute and tell us a few words about your ideas about scientific debates?
Yeah, Brennan here. Am I in?
Yes, you're on.
Okay, excellent. I'll be laying out the a perspective on the plume debate in just a few minutes. I think that it can be exciting to expose students to active debates in the discipline they're training in, and I think you know, we should be able to come up with some approaches to do that, some organized approaches. I have some general ideas, but I think we, you know, should be able to come up with some structured approaches to doing this. And that's something I see hopefully working on with some folks as we progress in this process.
Yeah, and again, at CERC, we have some great examples of case-based studies, problem-based learning, debate, directed inquiry, and so on. And I think all of those might be interesting approaches to these great scientific questions that we're looking at. And, of course, we'll hear more about that in about 10 minutes. Mary, you're online. Mary Kai. You work on isotopic tracers. Do you want to share a few thoughts about what you might want to do?
Hi. Can you guys hear me?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Well, it's very new that I can mute myself and unmute myself. So I am teaching a course called Frontiers of Science at Columbia, and we have a earth science component, and this year we're talking about volcanism and using some oxygen isotope case studies for students to get a sense of how geologists study deep earth. So I thought I would come here and get some ideas and material to develop a case study, new case study for students to use, to enjoy.
All right. Well, I personally can't wait to see that for my geochemistry class. That's going to be great. Suzanne, you talked about plate boundaries yesterday. Do you want to tell us a little more about what your thoughts are? Suzanne may be offline. I think she has her petrology course right now. Well, let me just put in a plug for anybody who knows how to use MELT. It would be absolutely great if we could do some kind of problem set about partial melting in the mantle, extraction of basalt, that type of thing. And I certainly would look forward to working with anybody who knows how to use MELT. Let's see. And then finally, there were a bunch of really cool ideas out there and groups that we may want to reach beyond our immediate geology core classes. Barbara, I see that you're online. Would you tell us a little bit about your program? And you had a special interest in teacher preparation.
Hi, can everybody hear me?
Yes, loud and clear.
Thank you. I teach gen ed courses, and so, yeah, you are the group that needs to reach out to me, actually. most of my students are gen ed, so they're everything from criminal justice majors to accounting, to a lot of them are elementary educators, and they come in and take my course because it is the easiest science course. So they come in with a phobia about science in general. And so I want to reach out to them and, you know, with enthusiasm and excitement and get them motivated about science in general. So this is all very overwhelming to me, this whole yesterday and today. And so I have all these thoughts and ideas about how to go and reach out to those elementary educators that are going to go out and start teaching in the classroom.
Yeah, boy, if we can hook them early, that would be just grand. And I was a program officer at the Division of Undergrad Education, and one of our huge programmatic focuses was pre-service teacher preparation, with the idea being that if we can prepare future teachers, that's really the piercing point for scientific literacy. So, boy, this is great work that
exactly. I'm getting thinking more critically than just kind of being more of a descriptive science approach that a lot of them use, is getting students more involved. And so I've got some ideas, and I'll be throwing them out on the on the threaded discussion to get everybody's input and ideas. So thank you.
Oh, great. And Barbara, while you're online, you also put in a comment about GIS. Do you want to share some thoughts about how you might use GIS?
I haven't really thought about that too much in the last day, but because my background is geography, I'm always interested in looking at the spatial relationship between the Earth's surface and the interior of the Earth, and also beginning to get some of my students begin to understand a little bit more about scale. I mean, to them, they just think, well, why don't we just drill to the interior of the Earth? So there's a real learning curve as far as understanding spatial relationships and scale. So we bring in GIS to begin to look at the different components of things that interact. So I haven't given it a whole lot of thought in the last 24 hours, but I've been working on that.
All right, cool. And I just follow up. Declan Dupour, unfortunately, is under the weather and hasn't been able to join us. I can tell you he's starting a national move to integrate GIS and Google Earth into the geoscience curriculum, and he's interested in 3D and 4D uses, 3D and 4D dimensional uses of GIS, and hopefully he'll be able to join us a bit later with some more ideas about that. Well, one of the ideas that I thought was way cool, and there was kind of a convergence here between Suzanne Baldwin and Vicki Hansen, and that was using deep earth science to demonstrate the nature of science. And Vicki, we haven't heard from you yet, so if you could patch in, what are some of your thoughts about this in your deep earth geodynamics course?
We have the Earth's Dynamic Interior, and it's a sophomore-level course. The idea is to get it right after majors and non-majors have taken intro. I must say we actually, it becomes a hook for a number of students, and there are also kids who are going to teach science who are in the class. And I have just found that the deep Earth is absolutely fascinating to these students, from how the magnetic field works to how we actually think about and know about the deep Earth. And so we start out with the scientific method and find out that students actually don't know much about the scientific method. They think that assumptions are bad in science. They don't understand that we require assumptions. And so we keep going back throughout the class to emphasize how do we know things, and how do we leverage that information. And so I'd like to have more interactive exercises to involve the students in these sorts of things, but they really come away with, I think, a much better understanding of science, and when they participate in the science, I think that's when they get excited, and they get so excited because there's so many questions that we don't know about for the deep Earth, and so like Brandon's idea about bringing in debates, I think, is a superb one so that the students could look into different aspects of debates and have the students debate it, but they actually see science in action.
Yeah, that's absolutely fantastic. Suzanne, do you have some other thoughts? You had some ideas along the same lines, I think. Okay, I think Suzanne might be...
Okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, hi.
Hi. I've patched in my metrology class, actually, and just in time to hear the lecture on plumes, which is totally relevant to what we're doing. So I missed much of the discussion between 11 and 11:30, or 10 and 10:30 your time. But the idea that I had was, with respect to looking at the transition between the core and mantle. In my mineralogy class, we have a discussion about how the meteorite palisades are used and thought to be representative of what the core-mantle boundary looks like. And we talk about iron of and you can certainly bring in discussions about coordination number that, and I used this program Crystal Maker to do that. But I also want to try and incorporate in you know, with some of the geophysicists, some of these images that we're getting from the core mantle boundary. I just described to my class here, you know, what was the view when I was in their seat, you know, of what the core mantle boundary looked like. And it was basically smooth, you know, it's just like concentric circles, you know, that we would draw of what the Earth looks like. And today we have the ability to kind of, you know, integrate data sets that give us a really exciting view of what might be happening down there.
All right. Well, thanks for those thoughts. And we're just about on schedule to start the advertised talk at the half hour. I don't want to cut this short in terms of importance, but the intro courses are a huge area of interest. And let me just say that there is a group here of many people that all have interest in teaching about deep earth to non-majors, and I really hope that we're going to explore those topics in more detail. So I think that we're ready to go. Mike, are you there?
I'm here.
Can you do the intro, Brennan?
Yep, will do.
Okay. Well, I want to thank everybody for this initial discussion. There's a lot of really rich ideas here. I do want to say before we do Brennan's introduction that at the end of the day, the expectation is that we are all going to start an activity sheet that's going to be the start of the outline of our new teaching activities. And we'll give you a brief run through the CERC content management system. And then you can, over the next couple of days, as we develop our activities, we can systematically upload files, Word files, PDFs, JPEGs, et cetera. And in some cases, we may want to create a special web authoring space for you as well, and we can do both. And when we talk about activity, let me just ask you to think broadly. It can be anything from a laboratory exercise, a problem set, maybe a hot topic, as Brennan talked about, for debate and class discussion, maybe a visualization collection with annotation, class demonstrations or experiments. This is all wide open. And so just think creatively and broadly, and we'll get back to you on this at the end of the day. So with that, Mike, I'll let you take over, and on with the show.
Okay, great. It's my pleasure to introduce Brennan Jordan a little bit to all of us. Brennan is in his fourth year at the University of South Dakota after having some stints at Whitman College and College of Worcester. And his interests, as we all know by now, are very much in plumes. And he has done research on high lava plains in Oregon. He's worked with students in Iceland and in Mongolia, all with a plume orientation. And today he's going to talk to us about the plume controversy. I think everyone can see this, getting students engaged with science and the conduct of science. So, Brennan, thanks a lot. We're looking forward to your talk.
All right. Well, thank you. It's a pleasure to be able to talk to this group and create a presentation that I take it will become one of the documents of this workshop. I assume I'm being heard.
Yes, you are. You're coming through good.
Excellent, excellent. Let me know if I break into too loud of a lecturing voice here. This would be my natural tendency. So I'm here to talk to you today about the controversy surrounding mantle plumes, and I'm going to be spending quite a bit of my presentation really introducing everybody to the controversy, and really we'll just finish up with some first thoughts about how we present this to students. An outline of my talk is on the current slide here, so I'll be beginning by talking about mantle plume theory or the hypothesis in general, and just a bit about the history, talking about the where the hypothesis stands today, and then introducing people a bit to the arguments against mantle plumes, as they are being presented today, and putting that in the context of an event that was held in 2005, an AGU Chapman conference entitled The Great Plume Debate. And then I'll be finishing up with a few thoughts, as I said, about talking about these things and bringing them in as activities in the classroom. So we'll get right to it here. Just a bit of the history, and this is, I'm sure, review for most people here, but the general idea of hotspots, if not the exact terminology, was proposed by Wilson, 1963, in a Canadian journal addressing the origin of the Hawaiian Islands primarily, but also other island systems away from plate boundaries. This was really happening right as, you know, there really wasn't plate tectonics quite yet. This was happening just as there was a growing support for continental drift and convection in the interior of the Earth. And in the development of these ideas, you know, Wilson came up with the hotspot as a way to explain age progressive volcanic islands, and he linked it with convection in the mantle. But the conception was primarily of a shallow phenomenon, as illustrated in one of his concluding figures in this slide. Even the geochronology at this point was pretty limited. He talked a lot about fossil evidence for the ages of the islands, and so that's where we begin. The really the idea of the mantle plume was proposed by Jason Morgan in 1971, you know, seeking a mechanism that could explain these hotspots in the context of plate tectonics, which was now becoming very well established. He proposed that these hotspots were manifestations of thermal plumes, and that if you're going to have a thermal plume, something that is rising because it is compositionally similar to but hotter than its surroundings and thus less dense, that that should arise from an instability at a thermal boundary layer, a point within the Earth across which the temperature changes rather dramatically, so a point where material above is heated from below. And the core mantle boundary is the obvious choice as the main major thermal boundary layer in the interior of the Earth. And so he came up with the idea of these mantle plumes, and also sourcing them deep in the mantle gave an explanation for the apparent fixity of hotspot volcanic systems with respect to one another. And beyond that, though, if one reads his paper, one will find that he also put plumes into the plate tectonic context in a broader sense, in a sense that is, you know, nobody, I don't think, would defend directly today, as plumes being an important driving force of plate tectonics, and within the context of flow in the mantle, dragging plates around, very much in contrast to our you know, primary current perspective, where the plates themselves, the lithospheric plates, are an integral part of the convection that you know, the slabs, the slab portions of plates provide the negative buoyancy that drives plate motion. So there's a lot more to his 71 paper than just mantle plumes, but that's certainly what it's known for. Let's see on. Sorry, I was clicking the arrow buttons on my computer as if I was giving a regular PowerPoint. This is Holden and Vaught's cartoon view, humorous critique view of Jason Morgan coming up with the conception of mantle plumes. And if you are not familiar with the Holden and Vaught paper, it was signed, published in, I think, EOS. It's available online and at mantleplumes.org, and something that is republished in the Plates, Plumes, and Planetary Processes GSA special paper, as is a follow-up, an updated version of their cartoons for the modern plume debate. And it's great fun. The original was also, it was a satirical poke at Mandelplume theory for the most part. Their current one is a little more balanced. It pokes fun at everybody. So I encourage everybody to check that out. Okay, so, you know, that's the starting place. Mantle-plume theory became a sort of a part of how geoscientists were considering the large-scale function of the Earth really pretty quickly at that time. But the mantle plumes were not a major research focus really until the late 80s and early 90s. At that time, in 1989, I don't mention it on this slide, but Richards et al. Published published an important article about plume heads and tails, and a pair of articles, Campbell and Griffiths, and Griffiths and Campbell, 1990, published the results of some tank experiments, some analog experiments, showing what these plumes might look like, and showing the that their results predicted the development of a large plume head followed by a hot tail. And this was embraced quite quickly because the it matched what we see in many places with many hot spot volcanic systems originating in a flood basalt system. And so this really energized plume research quite a bit. On this slide, you see an analysis of citations by Anderson and Natlin, 2005, showing the jump in the number of citations in which mantle plume occurs in the tidal at around that time. The current view of mantle plumes is really quite a bit different than the original Morgan hypothesis, and even deviates a bit from how we looked at mantle plumes in 1989 and 1990. One really important development that I think anybody who favors mantle plume theory would include in their basic statement of mantle plume theory at this point is that plumes, particularly perhaps plume conduits, will be deflected by mantle flow, and thus they will not necessarily be fixed with respect to one another or with respect to any external reference frame. And some of what I consider to be the first important real clear presentations of these ideas and analysis of these ideas was by Bernard Steinberger, starting in 1998 with his publication with Richard O'Connell. And moving forward with quite a few publications on this subject in which they were able to predict how plumes might move, how they might be deflected, and how those deflections might change over time based on a mantle flow imposed based on a realistic flow pattern with respect to current plate tectonic configurations. And so that was important. It's important to distinguish that this idea, the work of Steinberger and O'Connell and other work of Steinberger, is not really an ad hoc modification of mantle plume theory. It's very phenomenologically based, and the inputs are based on things that we really see with respect to modern plate tectonic motions and flow. Was followed with a different kind of perspective, the work by John Tarduno et al. In 2003 and subsequent research showing that the Hawaii hotspot had appeared to migrate with respect to latitude, particularly early in its history, and that this explains actually one point that had been really criticized by plume skeptics, the dramatic bend in the Hawaii Emperor Seamount chain, and that rather than having to view this as a change in the plate motions, which it's sort of hard to come up with a sudden jerky change in plate motion like that dynamically, that this could be understood with respect to the deflection and motion of the plume. That data was first presented in 2003, and the ideas have continued to be refined by Tarduno over the last 7 years, including some very recent work. Another addendum to the initial Morgan hypothesis includes a couple of ideas that I mentioned here, both of them well illustrated by the work of Farnitani and Samuel, 2005, and that's that we might be dealing with something other than just purely thermal plumes, that there may be compositional buoyancy issues involved, and they did some modeling of what they called thermochemical plumes, and that the result of this process, and in fact the result of numerical models other than theirs, show diverse morphologies in mantle plumes. And the on the slide right now is a time sequence of the evolution of one of their thermochemical plumes. And this particular one does include the development of a distinct plume head. It shows a plating out of the plume material at the 660 discontinuity, and some deflection of the plume in the transition zone and upper mantle above. So somewhat complex image. And then this is another slide from their 2005 paper, and what this is showing is a variety of different kinds of plumes, and this is not depicting them in the simple modeled state, but in the how they would appear in tomography. And this becomes a potentially important contribution, because if we are to believe that many of the hotspot systems are underlain by mantle plumes, the tomography of them, beyond fundamental issues with the tomography, which some people would raise, the tomography would reveal sort of diverse morphologies of plumes, and their results showed that their modeling suggests that that's what we would expect. So I include both of those as sort of fundamental modifications to the simple idea that all plumes are fixed and that they're simply head-tail systems. So the mantle plume hypothesis has a number of lines of support, and I list these here. Of course, the hypothesis arose from the observation of age-progressive volcanic chains at the time that hotspots were first proposed. There wasn't a lot of data about those kinds of age progressions, and as I described, some of it was even primarily fossil evidence. Now there's a rather extensive data set of geochronology that supports age progression in many but not all seamount chains that might be considered as possible hotspots. Another important observation that's in what most people would consider to be sort of fundamental to current plume theory is the observation of the high helium 3-4 ratio in some hotspot volcanics. The idea being that since helium 3 originates in essentially only formed during by primordial processes, it is limited and it outgasses from the Earth. It's the only material that leaves the planet in substantial quantity by natural processes. And helium 4 is produced continuously by alpha decay within the Earth, and So the observation of high helium-3-4 ratios in many hotspots suggests that the magnetism must ultimately be sourced from material that's coming from a deep and isolated reservoir, such as the lower mantle. There are other geochemical signatures as well. I'm not going to go into those at depth. A lot of isotopic geochemistry as well as trace element geochemistry that identifies several distinct reservoirs, all of which have interesting acronyms like high mu and FOSO and the such, and that that proponents of the plume hypothesis have been able to craft into a fairly coherent model for mantle plume geochemistry. Then there's seismic tomography. Seismic tomography has been evolving quite rapidly, and we're going to be hearing more about seismology later today. I heard a bit about it, quite a bit about it yesterday from Gene. And there's been the hunt for plumes and slabs with seismic tomography, and that has had varying degrees of success, but the results of Montelli et al. In a variety of papers using finite frequency tomography, what Gene talked about yesterday, have seemed to show that we have mantle plumes extending into the lower mantle, perhaps down to the core mantle boundary in a number of places. I'll talk about the critique of that later, though not in depth. As I showed you an analog model for plume development, there has been a lot of work on both analog and numerical modeling of mantle plumes, and it seems to provide a theoretical background that suggests that plumes should exist. Then there is the observation of geoid anomalies, geoid being an isosurface of potential energy around the Earth, and or an equipotential surface, I guess you could say, that is deflected when there are dynamic processes within the Earth that are not compensated, that for which the gravitation is not compensated, and predicted for upwellings in the mantle would be positive geoid anomalies, and some of the largest positive geoid anomalies on Earth occur in hotspots. And lastly, there are more here, but the last one I'll mention is that the emplacement of flood basalts or large igneous province is often preceded by uplift based on geologic evidence, and that is what is predicted dynamically by the action of a rising mantle plume. So this all sounds quite wonderful, and it seems like how could this possibly go wrong? But there was some opposition to the plume theory right from the beginning. I've highlighted Don Anderson here, one of the most vocal critics of this hypothesis. I'm using hypothesis and theory interchangeably here, and that's not good. We'll get back to that later. And Don Anderson, amongst others, recognized problems, potential problems with this hypothesis quite early. I guess as a member of the scientific community, I would say most coming of age in this time, I would say most of what I heard was people shouting him down. His view was not a popular view, and today still remains a minority view. In the early 2000s, the opposition to the plume hypothesis was, I would say, rejuvenated, re-energized. It has gained a lot of momentum, and we'll highlight mantleplumes.org, the work at first order of Gillian Folger, as being a catalyst for that. And while I'm talking about mantleplumes.org, I guess I'll mention that I consider it an outstanding resource. I myself, for what it's worth, happen to be a bit of a plume proponent, but I've got a very open mind and sometimes wonder if I'm a plume proponent for the right reasons, if there's really a scientific basis for my perspective, as I'll be discussing later. And so I greatly appreciate the high quality of the website and the tremendous diversity of materials that are supplied on mantleplumes.org. For what it's worth, while it is primarily a site for plume skeptical perspectives, they absolutely welcome contributions from plume proponents and people who are neutral in the middle. And so it has the potential to be a much more even, much more balanced site with more contributions. I have a page on that myself. Now, so what could be wrong with this Mantleplume hypothesis? There are a number of critiques, and I just list a few here. One critique is that many hotspots don't meet any sort of standardized list of plume criteria. One of the first and most systematic analyses of this was by Cordolo et al. 2003, and he analyzed five criteria that mantle plumes might be expected to have if they are originating from the lower mantle and perhaps the core mantle boundary. He used the presence of long-lived tracks, hotspot tracks, age-progressive volcanism. That's one. Two is the presence of flood basalts in the initiation of those tracks. Three, high buoyancy flux. Four, a helium or potentially neon isotopic indicator of deep mantle involvement. And five was the tomography, that there be that the tomography should be warm. He looked specifically at 500 kilometers depth, and so that with that analysis, he analyzed 49 hotspot systems, and he came up with seven that they were convinced were deep in origin based on the information they had available at that time. And so that's a big reduction in the list. And secondarily, if you have high helium 3-4 in some hotspot volcanic systems that appear not to be underlain by deep mantle plumes, then that would seem to shoot a hole in that criterion. And the use of it as evidence in support of the Mantleplume hypothesis. So this is the development of that kind of argument. There's also a critique of really the basic way in which the science has been done surrounding the Mantleplume hypothesis, that when a particular hotspot volcanic system does not seem to match these criteria, that modifications to the basic plume hypothesis are made just to fit that particular site. Then these modifications may be not testable, and then, we deviate from sort of the basic function of science as this process moves forward. And that's a fairly strong critique. The plume skeptics also argue that the tomography is often inconclusive, and they argue that it is commonly also misrepresented, that by saturating images that you can present a very colorful image that seems to show a deep mantle plume, but that the image is saturated so as to show bright red with even a very modest amount of velocity perturbation. So they also would criticize some in the tomography community for sort of cherry picking their tomographic models and presenting only the tomographic models that seem to show the plumes. So that's the tomography. They also suggest that there's a lack of evidence for high temperature in the hotspot volcanic systems, both in the geochemistry and in heat flow. And that's interesting because the opposite is argued in favor of the Mantleplume hypothesis, that astrology does show evidence for high temperatures. I'll talk about that in a moment. And then lastly, there has been advanced the argument that the helium-3-4 ratios and some of the other geochemical observations may be more easily explained by shallow processes. And there's probably some weight to, I would say, some of the geochemistry. I don't buy the helium-3-4 argument for a shallow reservoir. But since much of the geochemistry, isotopic and trace element geochemistry that we see associated with deep plumes is similar to slabs, and that's part of how we understand slabs accumulating possibly in the D-double prime layer at the base of the mantle is perhaps being the source of plumes, why shove it all the way down to the base of the mantle and then bring it up when it's potentially already up there? That's one of their critiques. So if we look at a number of different kinds, different issues, I think we can make the statement that I make at the top of the slide here. Wait a minute. Aren't both sides arguing opposite directions based on the same kind of data? You've got people looking at tomography, and some people looking at the tomography and saying, you see, there have to be plumes. Other people looking at the tomography and saying, look, this is proof that there are no plumes. You've got people looking at the geochemistry of the salts coming out of these systems and saying, look, you see, there's evidence for high temperatures in these magmatic systems. They require excess temperatures of, 150 to 250 degrees. Somebody else looking at data on the same rocks or similar rocks and saying, my modeling shows there's no excess temperature. And there are a number of places in which this is true. It's true with some of the geologic evidence, the discussion of whether there is uplift prior to the initiation of a flood basalt in different systems. A lot of debate back and forth. And follow up on this point by presenting you with some results from a little poll that I conducted in the wake of the AGU Chapman Conference in 2005 in Fort William, Scotland, the Great Plume Debate. This event brought together scientists on both sides of the debate, and I would say that the organizers, Ian Campbell and Gillian Folger, did a good job of bringing in people from both sides of the debate, unlike previous efforts, which tended to be more one side or the other. And I say that based on my experience of being there, and Vicky was also there and presented some really interesting work on Venus, and did a little battle with Warren Hamilton on that. That was fun. But we really did have both proponents of the plume hypothesis, plume skeptics, and a fair number of people who really identified themselves as being in the middle, as indicated by the poll results that I show you here. But what I did, I was trying to get at how this group of scientists viewed Mantle Plume Theory, whether they were skeptical or supportive of the plume hypothesis, or whether they were someplace in the middle. I wanted to see what lines of evidence they found most compelling, and that's what I'm going to present you now. These are some figures from a 2007 paper I published, which included a bit about this. So I asked, what arguments do you feel most strongly support plume theory? And it is summarized on this chart, and it broke supplied with respect to all respondents, as well as identifying the plume advocates, the folks in the middle, and the plume skeptics. And not surprisingly, amongst all groups, that is most supported is age-progressive volcanism, and that's not a surprise because that's really what gave rise to the whole thing in the first place. I think it's interesting to look at what else people found compelling. The seismic tomography, most folks found in that audience thought supported plume theory. The association with large igneous provinces was important. I would highlight that after age-progressive volcanism, the result that got the second highest support from plume skeptics in their statement, what most supports plume theory was actually the numerical and analog modeling. And I would highlight as having been present at the Great Plume Debate, that was the one thing that was only argued on one side. It may have just been, you know, who was present, but there were arguments presented in favor of plume theory based on numerical and analog modeling, and there was not a counter argument offered. So that stands particularly notable to me. The high magmatic temperature is mentioned, as well as the geochemistry here. And in both sides of this poll, I provided an out, which is the far right result, that there are no arguments that they feel support mantle plume theory. And obviously, the plume skeptics were quite supportive of that view. So then the associated question is, you know, what lines of evidence do you feel most strongly argue against the existence of mantle plumes? And I've ordered these on the basis of the all result, although keeping the sort of default pro-plume view all the way on the right there. But looking at these results, the number one concern that this group of scientists, mostly, you know, well-informed, I present this to you as a group of well-informed, somewhat balanced scientists, well, not necessarily balanced in a personal way, but balanced with respect to the group scientific perspective. These are what they thought the biggest problems with the plume theory were. And the number one is one that I've mentioned to you, that many plumes don't meet any sort of standard criteria. They also were concerned with problems with age progressive tracks. Some of the seamount systems don't actually have age progressions. Some simply not demonstrated, but some, you know, demonstrate to clearly not have an age progression. That's uncommon. Those are mostly very small systems. Lack of evidence of high temperature. That is this temperature debate is a big one. The geochemistry being more easily explained by shallow processes, as I discussed earlier. Large igneous provinces associated with extension and as a possible causative mechanism rather than a plume head. And then the other results have somewhat lower overall numbers. But I think it's very interesting to look at what, you know, a group of current interested scientists thought at that time. It informs us about the nature of this debate. As I say here, experts in each relevant field disagree about fundamental interpretations. Seismologists disagreeing, you know, and good seismologists. You know, we're not talking about all the smart people think one thing and all the lousy scientists think another thing. You know, really good people on both sides disagreeing about interpretations of the data in their field in ways that are fundamentally opposite with regard to the mantle plume debate. And so that means that we you know, in order to resolve the mantle plume debate, we really have to resolve the debates within each of these individual fields. And I ask how we're going to do that. Do we need more data in general? Probably some of that. Do we need different kinds of data? You know, that'd be something entirely new. Perhaps, as I'm starting to think about, maybe even geoneutrinos can tell us something about the composition of the deep interior of the Earth that other kinds of data don't. More data could be referring to, you know, getting more ocean bottom seismic data that gives us broader arrays in areas of suspected mantle plumes. Important to the seismology. Do we need entirely different techniques? I guess that's really, in a way, alluded to with my reference to geoneutrinos. I think there are a few, critical questions that I ask myself as somebody who, as I've told you, is somewhat partial to the mantle plume hypothesis. The mantle plume paradigm has been useful for interpreting a wide range of phenomena, a lot of the phenomena described earlier in this talk. Does that validate it? I think we have to say if we're following the scientific method and we're thinking carefully, conservatively, and cautiously about science, we don't want to just do that. If we just did that, you know, we might still be pretty happy with juice and climal theory. That something works is not proof that it's right. And so I have concern with that, but I think that's the number one reason why a lot of people are hesitant to even critically reviewing mantle plume theory, is that it just works so well in a lot of ways. And then a follow-up question, and one that the plume skeptic community asks loudly and often, is can the plume hypothesis be disproven? And they would say, no, it absolutely cannot be disproven, because every time some element is disproven, there's a modification made to it, and then that adhered to. Now, part of that can just be the process of science. You know, if you do a test, you have a hypothesis, you test the hypothesis, and your hypothesis is proven to be wrong. You, rather than starting anew, you might modify your hypothesis, but you do have to modify it in a way that is testable. And I think they would argue that that hasn't been done. I follow that up by saying, you know, if the answer is no, if we can't disprove the plume hypothesis, is it really science? Is it a scientific theory at all, or is it a matter of faith? And that is of some concern. I think we want to be cautious about finding ourselves drifting out into that terrain. One thing that we always comes up when we talk about there perhaps not being mantle plumes is, what else could they be? And I describe that here as one of the least satisfying defenses from the pro-plume community, because you could, if one disproved mantle plumes but didn't have an alternative, that would still be a very productive bit of science. Disproving a hypothesis, even without replacing it with another, it's not gratifying, but it is productive science. While I think this is an important question to ask, I don't think it's a defense for the plume model. So I want to distinguish that. Good question, just not a defense. Okay. It is a question that many of the plume skeptic community have considered, and they've come up with a number of alternatives. These alternatives are generally also site-specific and generally involve shallow processes, sometimes lumped together and summarized as the plate model. I would highlight that, of course, many of these are controversial, and most of them enjoy much less support in the geoscience community than the plume hypothesis, and some of them may be critiqued and disproven rather rapidly. That doesn't mean it's not worth throwing them out and considering them. And I again point you to mantleplumes.org for an absolute wealth of resources about this, about these alternative hypotheses. I'm going to quickly, because I don't have an awful lot of time if I'm supposed to leave time for discussion, I'm going to quickly move through what some of these alternative hypotheses might be, because particularly for those of you who haven't been close to this debate, you might be wondering, well, that question exactly, what else could it be? And one is that these hotspots, or I think properly the plume skeptic community would rather us call melting anomalies, they don't necessarily have to be hot, and they would argue they're not hot, is that they are fertility anomalies, that they consist of material that is simply more easily melted. It's easily melted perhaps because it's wet and you've got the reduced solidus in the presence of volatiles, or perhaps it's entirely different material that, you know, we're dealing with eclogite. We know there are processes that are jamming eclogite into the earth, and so the eclogite is more readily fused than peridotites, and so if we have a heterogeneous upper mantle, then places where there are eclogite, we expect to see anomalous volcanism. And then there are some site-specific examples that can include this eclogite component, and I point one towards one example that's been particularly well developed, although I don't know that anybody would say that it's been strongly supported, but it has been well articulated, and that's the Iceland example. Jill Folger in 2002 and Folger and Anderson 2003 and some subsequent work has proposed that that Iceland doesn't reflect the presence of a mantle plume, but rather reflects the intersection of the late Paleozoic Caledonian suture with the mid-ocean ridge, and that Caledonian in subduction into the Caledonian suture would have emplaced eclogite into the upper mantle there, and that subsequent mid-ocean ridge rifting would be decompressing that eclogite. They also argue that Iceland is misunderstood with respect to its basic structure, that it is underlain by it is likely underlain by some continental crust. That's very controversial. There have been some suggestion, only in abstracts, no published results, that give some ancient zircons, some Mesozoic and Precambrian zircons from Iceland. That's a long story that I can't go into here. Another hypothesis that you crack the oceanic lithosphere to explain the occurrence of these melting anomalies. There are different kinds of models there, whether it's cracking due to regional tectonic stress, or it's a thermal contraction in cooling lithosphere. Extension would probably be necessary if you need to decompress some mantle below to get your melting. Some folks, although this is not a popular view, Warren Hamilton has it, amongst others, suspect that there may be more partial melt at shallow depths in the mantle than we widely believe, and such that if you crack it, you could get some magma coming to the surface. Small-scale convection has been modeled by a number of people, and the small-scale convection phenomena would be particularly good for explaining the many small seamounts often occurring in linear chains that dot the seafloor, and some of which have been demonstrated to not have age-progressive volcanism associated with them. So I don't think many people would argue this for for the Hawaii system, for example, but for some of the other smaller seamount systems, it has been articulated. Edge-driven convection is a process that might occur early in the development of an oceanic basin and continue through much of its history. The idea is illustrated in the image on the left from King and Anderson 98, where you've got a thick, cold continental lithosphere essentially chilling the asthenosphere next to it, causing it to descend, and a rising warm cell to this system, this convective system, would then be a possible source of a hot spot. And the results of some numerical modeling to show this are shown on the right. More controversially, and extending into the ultra-controversial, perhaps fringe science, some would argue, but not everybody, obviously, is the potential for bolide impacts to create large igneous provinces and perhaps thermal perturbations that can survive as hot spots. This was advanced by Jones et al. 2002. I've borrowed a figure showing that shows where decompression could be occurring to create melts from Jones et al. 2002. And going perhaps a step further, Hagstrom 2005, in I think an EPSL article, argued that many hotspots have antipodal hotspots as well, and that the energy transmitted around the globe could be concentrated on the opposite side of the globe so as to produce hotspots on opposite sides of the planet. I'm giving you some of these. I'm not saying I support necessarily any of these. but I want to really try and evenly present both sides of the debate. And so now I want to take this to the classroom, and I'll try to wrap up quickly because I know I've only got 11 minutes and I was supposed to leave some time for discussion. I think that this this plume debate is a really ideal debate to expose students to an active debate in science, in our science, and it is a vigorous and active debate. And you know, when you tell students that we don't know something, that there's a really basic question that we don't know the answer to, there are two ways they could respond. One is skepticism about science in general. Well, you see, they just don't know anything. Why should we believe anything they say kind of perspective? And some folks are predisposed to that, some of them politically influenced in that way. But hopefully for many students, and especially for geology majors, this should be exciting. It should be exciting that we are still asking and trying to answer some very basic questions about how the Earth works at the largest scales, the most sort of fundamental scales of how the interior of the Earth works. And that this, you know, offers them a future in which they can explore these kinds of questions. And so, you know, when I present this, I try to emphasize this is good news for you guys. We're not just niggling with the details here. This is really good, you know, basic questions to be considered. One question we can ask of students at any level, if we expose them just a little bit to this debate. Is the plume explanation for melting anomalies a hypothesis, a theory, a law? At one point in putting together this slide, I was using theory, and then I thought more cautiously about what I was writing and used hypothesis. And I think many plume supporters would say that hypothesis is indeed most appropriate. I know. Norm Sleep, when carefully crafting his language, will use hypothesis here, in spite of the fact he's a strong supporter of the hypothesis. The debate, you know, when you're exposing students to a debate in the scientific community, you can take a sort of different look at just the character of the debate, the tenor of the debate. And I say here that, you know, depending upon one's perspective, the tenor of the plume debate could either be off-putting or kind of fun. It can be negative and off-putting, you know, when in some ways it becomes a bit like the creation evolution debate, where people don't seem to be listening to each other. There's even a bit of name-calling. And many of the scientific arguments are being advanced not by, you know, honest, straight reason, but with what I call here deceptive argumentation, where, you know, some facts are omitted and other ones emphasized, and purely tactical moves are made to advance one's perspective. On the positive side, exposing a student to the sort of raw nature of this debate shows them that this is a vigorous debate between intelligent and passionate scientists, and that's, you know, and that's a good thing. One thing I really wanted to highlight, I really encourage you folks to take a look at, is if you look at the post Chapman volumes, there were two volumes in the wake of that Chapman conference. One is the GSA special paper, Plates, Plumes, and Planetary Processes, which includes really papers on both sides, but maybe a bit more on the plume skeptic side. And well, I'd say more than a bit more, but quite a few plume supporters there as well. And then a chemical geology volume that came out in 2007, which had mostly plume proponents with one plume skeptical contribution. I would look at those, and if you really want to get a feel for some of the, you know, what I would call the ugly side of this. You can get a feel for it by looking at three documents, all of which are pretty easily found under the Plates, Plumes, and Planetary Processes tag at mantleplumes.org. And what I'm highlighting here is an editorial introduction to the special volume in chemical geology by Campbell and Kerr, and then a book review of the Plates, Plumes, and Planetary Processes by Kerr, and then a reply to that by Folger and Jurdy, the authors of the Plates, Blooms, and Planetary Processes volume. Both of those were in Marine Geophysical Researches. I didn't fully cite that in the second case. The back and forth there, I think, you know, if you want to show students, and I don't know that you do, but if you want to show students that people are really, you know, can be a little angry with each other, a little unpleasant with each other, that back and forth can do it. But more productively, I want to focus on something perhaps more uniformly positive. I point out to you that this the Plates, Plumes, and Planetary Processes is somewhat unique in our current literature in that after each paper chapter was submitted, there was an opportunity for folks to comment, other scientists to comment on the material of that chapter, and then for the authors to reply, and for there to be a dialogue. And I highlight for you one in particular. If I was going to pick one out and have students go through this, obviously they'd need to be advanced students. They'd need to be petrology students and for, you know, even best for graduate students. The Hooper et al. Contribution on the Columbia River basalts. After that chapter, there are a total of 8 comments by various, mostly, well, entirely plume skeptic scientists, and 5 replies from the author team or individuals in the author team. And this, you know, this ability to look and to see it going back and forth is in that form, and in this case, not ugly, no name calling, I think that's just a wonderful thing. And so I strongly encourage you to look into that and consider it, and it may be something that we try and flush out as an exercise in this workshop. Another idea alluded to before is that students could be assigned different perspectives in a dialogue like this, and asked to articulate the scientific points either in writing or face to face. You know, more broadly, they could be assigned different sides of the plume debate, or assigned different provinces and different sides of the plume debate, or assigned different hypotheses, the plume hypothesis and some of the alternative hypotheses. Write on them and perhaps have an in-class debate on this subject. And, I think, these are all options for how to bring this material into our classroom. I wrap up by just telling you, of course, what I've presented you is an overview of the debate, not a lot of detail. I strongly encourage you to dig a bit. Mantleplumes.org, in spite of mostly being a plume skeptic source, offers a lot of references. A lot of things are available as PDF files there. And a lot of it pretty well organized. So, if you want to learn more about any of these specific arguments, then please do dig into that. And I finish by, saying, what of this can we develop into activities? And so I thank you for your time. I've left 3 minutes for Q&A. Barbara's raising her hand.
This is Mike. There's been quite a discussion going on, Brendan. I don't know if you've seen it in the background, but
yes.
But we also want to ask if there's just any specific questions that people might raise right now about the presentation or points they might want to make, and then we could maybe do some general discussion too. People could either make it in the discussion thread or else unmute themselves and speak. Brendan, I asked just a general question somewhere up above there, but I wondered, you may have even said this, but I wonder about your working definition of a plume. Is it, in your mind, do all plumes go to the core mantle boundary, or is there a potential for half mantle plumes and shallower plumes, and does the definition of a plume and maybe convection get fuzzy if you think about it in one way?
Yeah, I would want to articulate a specific kind of plume hypothesis in a definition. So I would want to say that a mantle plume, in the context we're discussing it, is a plume arising from the thermal boundary layer at the core mantle boundary through the mantle to cause volcanism and associated processes at the Earth's surface. One can talk about whether or not there are shallow plumes. I think as a matter of defining a mantle plume, if we're going to all talk about the same thing, we want to talk about these potentially different phenomena as a different kind of entity. I don't want to overly blur the definition so that it's inclusive of everything that is a thermal upwelling inside the Earth. And I have trouble coming up with, at this point, really buying into large plumes that don't originate from the lower mantle. And the thermal boundary layer is, I would say, clearly critical to this. So I would want to keep that as part of the definition. And and if it's disproven, then that definition of a plume is disproven. Only by stating it clearly can it even be potentially disproven. That's one of the things that the plume skeptics will point out. I mean, one of the first questions they're often asking is, what the hell is a plume? Please give us a definition. And so your question is right online. I think that's something we have to ask and clearly articulate and make available for being disproved.
There's a lot of interesting comments that have been raised kind of while you were talking and just now just about the nature of hypothesis and a debate, and so you're stimulating people to think about it and talk about what they might do, but they're not really questions. You may
okay.
want to take your time and read them over a little bit.
Okay. No. Yeah. I will do that. Perhaps not
yeah,
while
right.
I'm talking.
Right. So it's just getting close to being 12:30, and I just wonder if there's any other comments or things that we should do right now before we adjourn for our break. Dave, do you have any other things you want to bring up right now?
No, I would just like to thank Brennan for just a fantastic overview of not only the science but the issues and some teaching ideas. I think that unless anybody else wants to patch in with a comment, I think that we should sign off and recover a bit and come back for Ray Russo at, I think it's 1 o'clock Central Time.
Great. Thanks a lot, Brennan. That was great.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
All right. Thanks, everyone. And we'll see you back here, same place at 1 o'clock Central.
Okay, great. There's some applause going on.